Bicentennial 6.
Welcome to Bicentennial 6. This series, produced by the Humanities Series, Midwestern Center, is funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. In this program, the sixth of 10 studies of ethnic impact on our American civilization, Mr. Gerhard Naseff, Associate Director of the University Library at Madison, Wisconsin, will speak on the Norwegians.
I will discuss the unique impact of the Norwegian people on America, and particularly on the Midwest. A people who, despite hardship and a history as a maritime people, found life on the plains in the Midwest to their liking. Specifically, I wish to mention the Norwegian contributions in the fields of agriculture, engineering, and education, as well as in politics, where they helped to mold progressive legislation profoundly affecting America over the past century. But how did the Norwegian come to America, and why did he come? Next year will mark the bicentennial year of American independence. Our country has already begun to celebrate the occasion. With very few exceptions, the Norwegians were not around to help the colonies as they broke away from England. They came a half century later. By useful coincidence, in 1975, the Norwegians on both sides of the Atlantic are celebrating the sailing of the first emigrant ship from Norway. The Restorasjonen left the southwestern Norwegian harbor of Stavanger on July 4, 1825, arriving in New York City on October 9th, a date now observed in many parts of America as Leif Erikson Day. On July 4th this year, the King of Norway is participating in a special observance of this occasion in Stavanger, and 3 months later will come to America to appear in several key cities for similar celebrations. Many American churches of Norwegian origin will also celebrate, with Norwegian bishops as the guest speakers. The Restorasjonen, a little sloop with but 52 passengers and crew, was just the beginning. In 1835, several ships arrived from Norway, marking the first of a growing stream of immigrants, numbering in 1 year as many as 29,000. This was in 1882. By 1910, official reports indicate that a total of nearly 700,000 Norwegians had made their way to American shores. Modern estimates suggest that in the United States today, there are at least as many persons of Norwegian background as there are in Norway itself. The emigrants left from virtually every southern port of Norway, Stavanger, Oslo, Bergen, Kristiansand, and others. On July 1, 1838, the first Norwegian to enter Wisconsin staked a claim on Jefferson Prairie in Rock County. 12 years later, in 1850, there were 9,467 Norwegians in Wisconsin, approximately three-fourths of the entire Norwegian population in America at that time. This first Norwegian was Ole Nottestad, whose brother Onstein had returned to Norway that same year, in 1838. Onstein told friends some years later that the report of my return spread like wildfire through the land, and an incredible number of people came to hear news from America. Many traveled as many as 20 Norwegian miles to talk with me. It was impossible to answer all the letters which came to me containing questions in regard to conditions on the other side of the ocean. Why Wisconsin? As always, the immigrants sought available land and at low prices. By 1839, much of the best land in Illinois had been taken. Besides, the reputation of Illinois had not been enhanced by reports of disease and hardship. It was reported that as one immigrant group was about to depart for Illinois, an American boarded their vessel with two companions, one robust, the other anemic. The immigrants were told, "Look, the robust man is from Wisconsin, where there is a healthful climate and food in abundance. The sick man is from Illinois." Naturally, the Norwegians chose Wisconsin. By 1860, there were 30,000 Norwegians in the state of Wisconsin alone. Among the best-known Norwegian settlements in that state are Muskego, Jefferson Prairie, Koshkonong, Rock Prairie, Spring Prairie, Coon Valley, and Coon Prairie. There are many, many others. 1839 marked the entry into Iowa of the first Norwegians in that state when two men chose land in Lee County near Keokuk. This settlement never became strong. On the other hand, there was a strong movement a few years later of Norwegians into northeast Iowa, into Allamakee, Clayton, and Winneshe counties. Settlements carried the colorful names of Painted Creek, Turkey River, and Washington Prairie. Other important settlements are to be found in Story, Mitchell, and Worth counties, with lesser settlements to be seen in many other parts of Iowa. By 1870, there were 25,251 Norwegians in the state of Iowa. Although migration into Minnesota started somewhat later, by 1870, there were almost twice as many Norwegians in that state as there were in Iowa. Again, the basic reason is that the good land in Illinois and Wisconsin had been taken. Another was the passage of the Homestead Act of 1862. In spite of Indian scares, the 1860s saw tens of thousands of Norwegians moving into the state. The greatest concentration was in southeastern Minnesota, in Houston and Fillmore counties, and soon in Goodhue County. However, virtually every county received its share. Time will not permit more than mention of the fact that Norwegians made their way in large numbers into the Dakotas, Michigan, Kansas, and later, of course, into the states on the Pacific coast. There is a strong Norwegian element in the Dakota counties bordering on Minnesota and Iowa. The Norwegians left their native land for a number of reasons, but the chief was economic. One historian, George Flum, lists the influences promoting immigration to be: first, the prospect of material betterment and the love of a freer land and more independent life. Second, letters from relatives and friends who had emigrated to the United States, and visits of these again to their native country. Third, the advertising agents of emigration. Fourth, religious persecution at home. Fifth, church proselytism. Sixth, political oppression. Seventh, military service. And eighth, the desire for adventure. Life for the early immigrant in America was far from easy. Land had to be cleared before agricultural progress was possible. In fact, often this was done before a house was built. Many settlers lived in dugouts for a time. Mrs. Elizabeth Corin describes the Eggy cabin where she and her husband lived for a time with the Eggy family. The house is 14 by 16 feet, divided by curtains of calico into two rooms, one of which affords space for two beds, which extend along one wall of the house and are separated from each other by a second curtain. The same writer describes another house in northeastern Iowa. This is a very large room, running the length of the house, with an ordinary little stove in the center, which falls far short of heating so large a room to the proper temperature. The house, though new, is a poor sort of place. The floor consists of unfinished planks which bob up and down when walked on. At one end is a passage to the cellar, covered with a couple of loose boards laid an inch apart. The ceiling, likewise, consists of rough boards, through which one can see into the loft and even catch a glimpse of the sky through the roof. There is a bed near the cellar trapdoor, and beneath that a chest which is drawn out in the evening to provide for the family's youngest members. On the other side of the window there are shelves full of tools. At the farther end of the room, Ingeborg has her milk shelves and other kitchen articles. For those times, these homes were probably typical. One historian quotes an American minister who visited the Muskego settlement in the 1840s. The amount of wretchedness and suffering which prevailed was such as absolutely to mock all description. One settler wrote home to Norway from Muskego that 68 persons had died from the group which had come from the community of Tinn in Telemark. Small wonder that it was several years before any more men and women came from Tinn to America. It is tempting to discuss in more detail the settlement by the Norwegians on the Midwestern prairies. But now we must move on to a consideration of the impact of these Norwegians upon that area and upon America. The Norwegian immigrant made himself felt first of all in the field of agriculture. While a good number of these immigrants made their way to the towns and cities, where they engaged in a variety of occupations, the clear majority came as farmers and remained farmers. As late as 1900, approximately 50% of the first-generation Norwegians in America were engaged in agriculture, the highest percentage of any national group in America. True, there were more Germans, English, and Irish in terms of numbers, but not in percentage. I know of one township in Fillmore County, Minnesota, where in 1880, every person but one was of Norwegian birth or ancestry. All of them were engaged in farming. Many other rural areas in the Midwest are comprised almost entirely of Norwegians. Because of the proximity of the sea back in Norway, it was natural that a great many Norwegian sailors found themselves at home on the American coast and on the Great Lakes. How many will probably never be known, because so many were persons who deserted in American ports. Many Norwegians went just as naturally into the fishing industry. One official estimated some years ago that between 80 and 90% of the fishermen along the north shore of Lake Superior were Norwegians. The Norwegians have played an active role in the development of the industry on the Pacific coast. They played a part also in yachting. The famous British racer, Sir Thomas Lipton, engaged the services of Norwegian sailors on his various Shamrocks, which competed with yachts also manned to a large extent by Norwegians. I have indicated that a large number of the Norwegian immigrants were engaged in agriculture. True. Others took up mining, mechanical and manufacturing, transportation, business, domestic and personal service, the ministry, and other professional work. In the field of engineering, some of the contributions of the Norwegians have been more visible. For example, Eivind Lee Heidenreich, a Norwegian from Bergen, has been known as doing as much as anyone to introduce to America reinforced concrete and to help it through its early stages. He also was the inventor of the modern type of grain elevators. Christian Anker Holt was the first to employ the caterpillar principle on plows and similar machinery. And there was Edwin Rood, who invented the automatic water heater. And Henrik Loss from Kristiansund designed the hydraulic machinery required for the construction of nearly all of the tunnels under the Hudson and East Rivers in New York City. Kenneth Bjork, in his book, Saga in Steel and Concrete, tells the story of these and many, many other engineers from Norway who did so much in America to make it the great country that it is. The Norwegians not only invented, they built. J. Haakon Hoff was the builder of no fewer than 18 bridges for the Chicago Great Western Railway. The first tunnel under the Detroit River was made possible by a solution which was due entirely to the ability of another Norwegian, Olaf Hoff, brother of Haakon mentioned a moment ago. The engineering work for the Woolworth Building in New York, long the world's tallest building, was performed by two Norwegians, Gunvald Aus and Cort Berle. A historian of American architecture says of the Woolworth that it remains one of the great architectural creations of all time. It is, of course, a fact that a great many Norwegians have taught in the colleges built by the Norwegian Americans. I have known many of them. Some of them were my teachers. If there were time, it would give me pleasure to go into some detail about them. Instead, I will limit my comments to some persons who distinguish themselves in state universities. There have been several university presidents. Conrad Elvium, president of my own University of Wisconsin, was a well-known biochemist. One of his outstanding discoveries was the use of nicotinic acid in the cure of pellagra. He sought to learn the nutritional requirements needed by man to maintain the health of the human organism. In his opinion, vitamins should be obtained from natural foods if possible. Generally, they are cheaper, more palatable, and in better balance with other factors when taken in this form. Three other university presidents have been Frederick L. Hovde of Purdue University, John Widtsoe, University of Utah, and Martha Peterson of Barnard College. Among the most influential university professors, I might name Paul Naplund of the University of Wisconsin, chairman of its history department, authority on British Commonwealth history, especially from the day of William Gladstone. Also, Alfred Aure of the University of Minnesota, recognized as one of the foremost dental scholars and educators in the United States. Dr. C. Walton Lillehei was a pioneer in open-heart operating procedures and innovated many techniques of modern heart surgery that have since become standard. As a child, he displayed a surgeon's dexterity, periodically taking apart and reassembling his father's Model T Ford. Another leader in the field of medicine was Ludwig Hechtoen, one of the most eminent pathologists and bacteriologists in our country. Another was Gunnar Gundersen, still active as a physician in La Crosse, who served as president of the American Medical Association. A man who did much to modernize librarianship was J.C. M. Hansen, for a time with the University of Chicago, and long a leader at the Library of Congress. He developed the Library of Congress classification system, which now is used in research libraries around the country. A few Norwegians in America were leaders in music. Best known a century ago was Ole Bull, called in at least one early record the greatest violinist in the world. Another says that he played Norway's folk music in the highest circles of Europe, in the presence of kings and emperors. This man lived for some years in Wisconsin, especially in Madison. Opera fans will long remember the Wagnerian soprano Kirsten Flagstad. In an earlier generation, Olav Fremstad was equally well known. An early president of the Violin Makers of Association of America was Knut Reindahl. In the field of choral music, the Norwegians have produced several leaders. Best known was F. Melius Christiansen, whose compositions and arrangements have been sung by church and college choirs across the land, and whose St. Olaf College Choir was long regarded as the finest college a cappella choir in the United States. A Norwegian with an Italian name, Carlo A. Sperati, developed the Luther College concert band to a high degree and took it to Norway in 1914 as a part of the centennial of Norwegian independence. And what about sport? There was a Vossing by the name of Knut Rockne, whose father came in 1893 to Chicago to exhibit his handicraft as a carriage builder at the Chicago Exposition. He liked what he saw and sent for his family. Knut went to college at Notre Dame University, where as team captain in football, he developed a new technique for forward passes, promulgating the stern dogma that each play should start with the idea that it aimed for a touchdown. As a coach, his record was 105 wins, 12 losses, 5 ties. In 1930, his team was given the National Football Championship. His technique was summed up in 3 principles: the perfected forward pass, hard tackling, a peculiar style of blocking, diagonal charging, and the shift, or shifting backfield. His methods were widely imitated. As one coach put it, it was left to Knut Rockne to stamp the imprint of his own personality over a nationwide football field and to contribute more than any other single individual to the growth and improvement of the modern game. Another gifted athlete was Babe Diedrichsen, who at the Olympic Games of 1932 won the javelin throw and set new records in the 80-meter hurdles and the high jump. She excelled in many other sports. For example, in the years 1940 to 1950, she won every available golf title. The Associated Press named her the woman athlete of the first half of the 20th century. A gifted artist was Herbjørn Gausta, whose paintings are to be found on many church altars as well as in the Norwegian American Museum. Men in politics and government are more visible than many others. This is true also of the Norwegian American. No Norwegian has yet been elected president of the United States, although some authorities very proudly trace the ancestry of George Washington back to some of the early lords in Norway. One has come close, namely Hubert Humphrey, who served 8 years as vice president. Another, Senator Henry Jackson, is a contender for the nomination in 1976. A recent Chief Justice of the Supreme Court was a Norwegian named Earl Warren. The names of Washington, Humphrey, Jackson, and Warren scarcely sound Norwegian. In some instances, the Norwegian comes from the maternal side of the family. In others, the name has been changed, as so often happened with difficult Norwegian surnames. One should never underestimate the power of the press. There is a story about 2 Norwegian immigrants who arrived in New York City. They were both tremendously impressed with that metropolis. One remarked to the other, "This city is really something." Whereupon the other replied, "True, but wait till you see Decorah." This reaction is explained by the existence of a Norwegian paper published in Decorah, Iowa, called Decorah Posten. Not a few subscribers were to be found in Norway. They found the news in Decorah Posten so persuasive that they knew that Decorah, at present a city of 6,000 inhabitants, surely was much larger and more impressive than New York. Several other Norwegian newspapers have influenced their readers in America, not only in providing information about their fellow immigrants, but also in offering opinions in matters of politics. To mention but a few, Skandinaven in Chicago, Minneapolis Tidende, Nordisk Tidende in Brooklyn, Western Viking in Seattle. The latter two are still published regularly. Decorah Posten ceased publication after almost 100 years. There are many who would claim that the Norwegians have been well assimilated into the American scene. This is true enough. On the other hand, many others are continuing some of the customs and traditions of the past. For example, several communities in the Midwest observe annually the Norwegian Independence Day, the 17th of May, Den 17. Mai. But one day is not enough, as it is in Norway. Usually, a whole weekend is set aside for this purpose. In fact, when the 17th of May falls during the middle of the week, it is possible for a person in Madison to celebrate this holiday for 9 days, that is, on 2 consecutive weekends. Stoughton provides parades, folk dancing, exhibits, good food. Traffic on Federal Highway 51 is rerouted to permit Stoughton's main street to be closed. Last year, a special feature was a church service in the Norwegian language. Mount Horeb has for several summers provided an outdoor theater play called The Song of Norway in a beautiful amphitheater setting and largely with a local cast. Decorah, Iowa annually has a Nordic fest with parades, folk dancing, good food, rose-mauling exhibitions and contests, special lectures. The city's Norwegian-American Museum has been described as the best ethnic museum in America. May I offer a postscript? Earlier in this talk, I have mentioned several organizations which have contributed and continue to contribute to the study of Norwegian-American history and culture. They are worthy of support by those interested in learning more about themselves and their heritage. In particular, I wish to mention the Norwegian American Historical Association, which this year is celebrating its 50th year, and which has published 48 books of high caliber. Anyone interested in history will profit by reading these books, all of which have been written in the English language. The association is based in Northfield, Minnesota. The Norwegian American Museum in Decorah, Iowa has a large collection of artifacts and has taken many steps to preserve such items and to further the study of Norwegian and Norwegian American culture by sponsoring fellowships as well as study institutes in the field of handicrafts. I have attempted to provide an overview of the impact of the Norwegian immigrant upon America, as it is demonstrated in a number of fields. Along with the immigrants from many other European countries, the Norwegians have done much for the land of their adoption. I am hoping that my words have inspired many of my listeners to want to read and learn more about this fascinating chronicle. If so, you can do no better than to begin with the books of the Norwegian American Historical Association, which cover so many facets of this history.
Da veike vårdan den reikis leida, komme alli ohoje mei.
The Humanities Series Midwestern Center wishes to thank Mr. Gerhard Naseth of the University of Wisconsin for his presentation on the Norwegians. Next time, on Bicentennial 7, the Dutch will be our ethnic study, and our guest speaker will be Mr. Willard Wickers of the Netherlands Museum in Holland, Michigan. Bicentennial 6 was produced at the University of Wisconsin Telecommunications Center.